Andrew.
Yes.
I'm looking at the magazines next to me here, and on the spine of issue 9, the thing at the end is 79.83%. What's that a reference to?
That was what I got in my A-level chemistry.
Right, okay.
One extra mark would have made it an A. Instead, it's the highest B of all time ever recorded. Hello, everybody. It's time for Linux Voice Podcast Series 3, Episode 3. How's everybody doing?
I think we've all got colds or we're all dying or something.
That's right. This is the special plague issue edition broadcast. We've all got plague. Never mind. So turn the volume down.
Yeah.
And listen, you know, put some sort of, put a bit of tissue paper over the speakers so that the germs can't get through.
Make sure you're running antivirus software.
And we'll try and get through the next planned 45, but actually more like 65 minutes without infecting you with our lurgy. We're going to do this in alphabetical order of our first names. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I am Graham Morrison.
And I am Mike Saunders.
And in this wonderfully prepared and skillfully executed podcast, there'll be news, there'll be a halfway reminder, there may or may not be neurons, and there'll be discoveries, and there'll be the results of our internet-famous Voice of the Masses. If you like the sound of this, but with even more tutorials and learned stuff and reviews of cool bits and stuff that we get sent in the mail, and software that we download... If you like the sound of that and would like to read it on paper, or indeed on EPUBs or on PDFs, you can subscribe to Linux Voice, our magazine, and that's at shop.linuxvoice.com. So, are we about ready to kick on with this?
All right, should we march on with the news?
News time.
News. This fortnight, our news is nicely sliced into two categories. We have hardware news and software news. We shall start with software news.
Can we have a halfway reminder for the news?
Why not?
Yeah. Is there any firmware news?
There's no firmware news this fortnight.
Oh, shame.
So, yeah, first up on the news, Crunchbang is no more, but it lives on as Crunchbang++. This takes the basic ideas of Crunchbang, a nice, sleek desktop interface already set up, ready to go. Adds it to Debian Jesse, so a slightly more updated version than the old Crunchbang. And, the idea is to keep the spirit the same and for the ideals of the project to live on with new maintainers. Now Core Nominals step down. There are betas available and, expecting more versions coming up.
So who's behind the plus version? Is it some previous Crunchbang developers, or?
I haven't actually seen. I mean, I assume it's a bunch of the users. I don't know how split up it was before, how much Core Nominal did and how much other developers did. I always got the impression it was a bit of a one-man show.
Yeah, I thought so as well.
I could be mistaken in that.
He also closely followed the Debian release schedule, so it kind of meant that there was a long periods of time where nothing happened or nothing appeared to happen. So I suppose that's, you know, and I think, you know, over the last few years, quite a few things have changed in his life and maybe in his approach to Crunchbang.
Yeah. I mean, it is a huge commitment doing a distro, and you can't, well, not everyone can maintain it indefinitely. Yeah. And, so yeah, let's hope Crunchbang++ does keep all the good bits of Crunchbang living on for all the people who want to use them.
It's great.
I'd like to...
Yeah, sorry.
I'm sorry.
I was only going to say that when people take on... when people are happy to continue a project, when other people in the community take on a project like Crunchbang, I think it's, you know, it's a really great indication of, firstly, how good the distribution was or how good the project was and how open the community is for people to take on the responsibility. And that's a really positive sign. I hope Crunchbang continues.
Yeah, I was just going to give a mention to a distro inspired by Crunchbang, which is Archbang, which some people have probably heard of, but I run it in a VM because I find Arch Linux fantastic for getting, obviously, the latest software very quickly to review. But I can never be bothered installing Arch. I can't be bothered going through the whole procedure because I've done things like that a million times.
The wiki's very easy to use. It's very easy to use.
Just read the wiki. But yeah, so Archbang is great. So it gives you a minimalist open box desktop, and then you can Pac-Man SYU to your heart's content. But after reading the news on the site, of course, always.
So yeah, next up in our software news section, GPG was very badly funded. It's now not. basically the developer, a German chap named Mike, you might have to help me with the pronunciation here. CH in German, is that a sound?
Yeah, it's more of a harsh sound. Give it a go. Try his name.
That's cruel, Mike.
I don't even know what his name is, so I'm going to.
If I'm pronouncing it correctly, and I apologize if I'm not, it's Werner Koch.
Werner Koch.
Werner Koch. There we go.
Dunno.
He originally developed it in 97, and he reckons he's been earning around $25,000 a year. That's dollars American. I read this on an American news site, so I assume he actually earned it in euros. But anyway, yeah, up until now. I don't know why I got sidetracked by currencies there. I've been dealing with currencies all weekend, looking into Bitcoins and various other cryptocurrencies. So my mind is closely attuned to...
Are you rich yet, Ben?
I'm not. My weekend's dealing in Darkcoin, Litecoin and Bitcoins has yet to make me rich.
How's the Linux voice stash of Bitcoins? How are we doing?
Our Linux voice stack of Bitcoins is slightly up.
Yeah!
as are all stacks of Bitcoins, in fact. Ours aren't special. anyway, back to GPG. There was a news article about how, you know, it's really important software because it's obviously most famously for email encryption, but it's actually used for loads of other stuff, for signing packages and all that sort of jazz. So it's far more than just email encryption. And there's a news article about how this one guy developing it was getting a bit skint. And then it turns out he just got $60,000 from the Linux Foundation. Facebook and Stripe each pledged $50,000 a year for development. And a community jumped in and donated €120,000 in one day. And the fundraising campaign is now up to €220,000.
That is awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah, so presumably he's now no longer developing GPG and swimming around Scrooge McDuck style in a massive vat of money.
That is brilliant.
And there are sort of two sides to this news. One is that it's obviously really terrible that such a core piece of software was almost forgotten about funding-wise for so long.
It falls into the SSL category, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah. But obviously the good news is that from now on, this particular piece of software is doing well. Whether or not there's other critical pieces of software that are also struggling for money, I don't know.
I guess we'll probably talk about funding and stuff like that later on in the Voice of the Masses. But I think this, with recent examples in their free software with the GNOME Foundation as well, looking for money to defend itself, and this, it just shows that when people ask, at least, I think the free software community is always willing to provide for projects that are this important.
Yeah, and I think part of it is it's not, you know, you sit down and you use Debian or whatever distro you use, and you like the software, but it's not always clear to you who, if you wanted to donate X amount of dollars or pounds, whatever, who you'd give it to. Should you give it to Debian for packaging it? Should you give it to, you know, who? There's no sort of umbrella organization that parcels out the money in a nice way.
But as the other thing is that I think there's a problem, like, I think this is a wider problem in the way that people ask for money, in the way that, like the App Store model, for example. So many people don't spend 69p on something they think that's worthwhile, but they'll still spend a lot of money on a cup of coffee. And
yeah,
there's something about the direct kind of request for this kind of money and people's, I don't know, it's the same with crowdfunding. There's something of people are investing something of themselves in something. I don't know. There's kind of some humility, or there's a humbleness to it that I think people are much more willing and more prepared to spend money on or give money when it's something like this. And I think there's a wider problem, which maybe talk about with elementary OS, in, you know, what is the right way of doing it? Is there a right way of doing it? Because I don't think it's a problem that's been at all solved yet. It's the same with publishing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, well, yeah, we'll come on to it later, so I shall hold my thoughts on that subject. So that brings us halfway through the news. expect another halfway reminder halfway through the podcast.
That's excellent.
So onto our hardware news. Obviously, the big, big hardware news of recent days is the new Raspberry Pi. The Raspberry Pi version 2. Coming with a quad-core processor, more RAM, more everything. Actually, not more everything, about the same of most things. but more cores and more RAM and more speed. We got one of these a couple of weeks ago as a sort of early thing to test out. And I've been using it quite a bit. And it's a much, much nicer computer to use as a sort of general desktop-y machine. There's much less sitting around waiting for stuff to happen that was really bad at times in the Raspberry Pi, particularly things like installing software, things like JavaScript-heavy websites that just brought the whole thing to its knees for, even if it's only for 30 seconds, that's really annoying when you're using it.
It's got double the RAM as well, hasn't it?
Yes, it goes up to a gig of RAM. From 512.
I mean, I never recommended the original Raspberry Pi as a desktop computer, despite the fact that the foundation and lots of other people said it was feasible. I just thought, God, you're just going to put somebody off Linux for life if you put that in front of them.
Yeah, I always thought turbo overclocking, it was just all right. But this is a much nicer computer. It's by no means fast, but it's much more responsive, and I think that's due to both the extra RAM and the fact that it's got more cores. So even if one process is just churning away for a minute, it doesn't lock up the computer as a whole.
Do you think it's genuinely feasible as a desktop? I mean, is it the kind of thing you might want to buy for your children, for example, with a cheap screen and keyboard and set them up with an LXDE and a web browser?
To a certain extent, it depends on what you expect it to be used for. If you sort of light general use, I'd say it's fine for. But if you're the sort of person who likes to have 50 web browser tabs open and running all sorts of fancy JavaScripty sites, it's going to crawl to a halt. It's certainly feasible as a regular computer, as long as you keep in mind what it is.
So what is the upgrade path like? Are the GPIO pins the same? And
nothing should change. You can take an SD card. Actually, no, you can't if you've got an old SD card. If you've got the latest version of Raspberry, you can swap it between two versions of Raspberry Pi. The hardware, run the same software. That should include GPIO stuff, although I know there has been a slight delay in some of the libraries, but I think everything's running now.
We should perhaps also note that, even though it's not really relevant to us, but this Windows 10 is going to be available for it for free or something, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't quite know what to make of that, to be honest, because you can run Windows 10, well, you will be able to run Windows 10 on it, but I don't know what you could then do with Windows 10, because all the things a Raspberry Pi is good at, Windows isn't. And I don't mean this as just generic Windows bashing. I mean this in the very specific case of this. Because, I mean, any of the sort of software that's not available for Linux isn't going to run well on it. You know, you say, oh, I want Photoshop and there's not a version. Well, great, you ain't going to get Photoshop to run on this or anything of the like. And things the Raspberry Pi is good at is things like the using hardware, physical computing, all that sort of stuff. I assume there will be libraries available for Windows, but without the sort of the whole tool chain, things like just being able to apt-get the libraries you need, this is Linux's bread and butter. This is Linux at its best, really, and Windows just can't compete with that.
Yeah, it does seem like Microsoft's just seen like, hang on a minute, how many of these things have they sold? We need to be involved here somehow, even if we haven't got a particularly suitable platform.
Yeah, in some ways it might actually be beneficial because things like schools might think, oh, it can run Windows, that's great. And when they actually get it and they go, actually, Windows is a bit rubbish on this, let's use Linux instead.
Yeah.
It is hard to see the use case for Windows on it other than just saying, oh, it looks runs Windows.
We all know that the best operating system to run is RISC OS as well.
I think it's a huge development that Microsoft has done this and recognized, I think, that the Raspberry Pi is enough of a threat that it needs to do something about it, even if it's just a token offering of its latest operating system running on it. I think that we haven't seen how it runs, but you could see, and I think maybe you were saying this, Ben, you can see, like in an educational environment in particular, that schools and places may feel a lot more confident in if they've got a lab of Raspberry Pis running a version of Windows than they would be were it a version of Linux.
Yeah, and I think one of the good things about the Raspberry Pi is, you know, the school can go, oh yeah, we've got all these Windows Raspberry Pis, but it's not like you have to go and reinstall anything, just whack in a different SD card and you've got Linux.
Yeah.
You don't have to delete Windows off anything. You don't have to repartition anything, just put a different SD card in. The only one thing that concerns me a little bit about this is, does this mean Microsoft are going to try and lock Minecraft to just the Windows version? Because that is, it's such a popular thing for the...
Yeah, and also, isn't Microsoft's like relaunching the Minecraft conference? They're going to make it a huge part of, I think I'd say yes. They're going to make it specific to their own platforms.
Yeah, I mean, they can't actually withdraw old Minecraft support, I believe. They cannot add patches, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But I doubt they can actually stop the current version from being released.
But it's a really sad thing. And I'm still slightly kind of angered that, you know, Notch said that there'll come a time when Minecraft would be open source, you know, and that would have been an amazing thing to have happened. But, you know, it's in the hands of Microsoft now, and Notch has bought a house in Beverly Hills.
There is MineTest, isn't there? There is the open source clone. I don't quite know what status that is in terms of completeness, but some hope for the future.
I'm told MineTest is pretty good. I've never used it that much. I don't know how well it runs on the Raspberry Pi. But yes, so that is this is our second halfway reminder for halfway through the hardware news.
and it's a three quarters reminder for the whole news.
Yes.
Okay, good.
So, yes, our final big bit of hardware news is Ubuntu phones now actually exist, and you can sort of sometimes maybe buy them if you're quick. So, they were released about a week ago. They sell for 170 euros on the BQ website, but they're releasing them in little batches in some sort of marketing stunty thing that just confuses me horribly. Why can't you just let people buy your hardware? But anyway,
it's got to be to generate a kind of buzz and an excitement. Yeah. And you know,
it's sold out. Then don't you realize how big that is? It's sold out within hours.
Yeah,
that's only because they didn't go and get the key and open the cupboard with all the other ones in there.
But that's fine. But you mentioned that in paragraph 3, the headline is that it's sold out.
This is why I don't like marketing. Just let people buy your hardware. So the specs have got 1.3 gigahertz quad-core A7 processor, which is actually very similar to the Raspberry Pi. It's clocked slightly faster. Mali graphics, 8 gig of storage, 4.5-inch 244 PPI screen. All that sort of goodness. Graham, I believe you actually have touched one of these devices.
I have, actually. It's here. This is the Ubuntu phone. Ooh. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's exactly the same as the E4.5 that BQ sells with Android running on it, and the same price. Canonical obviously knows that there's a lot of people who want this, a lot of geeks who want this, and I think that's who they're selling it for, and that's fair enough, in fact. So the phone itself is really nice. The size and the weight of it, I've not used the E4.5 before, but in comparison to my Nexus 5, it weighs about the same. It's about the same physical size. The screen is a lot lower resolution, but I'm pleased to say I don't notice that at all. And the responsiveness. So Canonical's taken a lot of Google Android code, especially for all the drivers and the hardware, and incorporated that into its own OS. And what Canonical really likes to push on this is that it's not an apps-based phone. It's a phone based on scopes. And what they mean by that is that a scope aggregates content from lots of other providers. So, for example, the news scope. So the news scope incorporates news stories from RSS feeds, effectively, however you may configure it. So BBC and Guardian and whoever else. So that works well. And it works also for the nearby. It tells you what's nearby.
But is there going to be an app store or marketplace?
There is an app store. Yeah, the app store is already there. The Ubuntu store is it's the same Ubuntu store that's been there for a while. And it's Alan Pope's already written a Linux voice app, if you want to that automatically gets our latest podcasts. In fact, you can see the little LV logo maybe there on the App Store screen.
Oh, yes.
Thanks, Alan. It's really good. I really like it. They've tried to differentiate themselves from Android and iOS. And bearing in mind, you know, Canonical's done this with, you know, they have 600 employees. And Samsung just moved 1,000 of its employees to the Tizen department, you know, and they can just do this overnight.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of admiration for them attempting to do this and for them attempting to diversify. There's a lot of Linux and Ubuntu love that's gone into the creation of this phone, and it feels like it. The other thing is that it is all genuinely open source.
There are also rumours of a higher spec'd phone from Meizu coming in the next few months. But I don't have any insider info on this, so we'll have to wait and see. And this is our 100% reminder.
And to prove that we don't know anything about marketing, you can read more about the latest edition, the latest Raspberry Pi, in the forthcoming Linux Voice that's going to be on shelves near you very, very soon. Ben's done a big bunch of benchmarks, and I've not actually seen any other news or Linux outlet do that to the same depth. So hats off to Ben and your awesome Raspberry Pi skills, but not your marketing skills.
That's a problem. You can actually buy the Raspberry Pi, so obviously they're terrible at marketing.
Yeah, they did. Actually, they did a brilliant job of that. They sold like 200,000 in the first week or something, which is brilliant.
But they didn't sell out. Amateurs.
Fines of the fortnight. I asked IRC because that's what I've done the last couple of times. So there's been a few there's been a few ideas. Firstly, James Olympus says, sorry to hear that we're all suffering from colds.
Thanks, James.
He then posts a link to the Raspberry Pi blog, where they list a load of emulators now running really awesomely on the Raspberry Pi Model 2. And this is true. They do look really good. I haven't tried any, but it'd be nice to try and get an Amiga emulating running full speed. James says, he's been playing PlayStation games with the PCSX rearmed emulator. I also had a reminder about the availability of Marmite Easter eggs that I have to mention. That's from Nano Phoenix. OpenRA, an open source command and conquer game. Oh, that sounds quite interesting. considering, yeah. NanoPhoenix also says, I discovered LS Topo yesterday, which can generate an SVG map of your PC's hardware from the command line, which is quite useful. And that's it. I think there's a bit of a discovery then about RISC-OS and the demise of Archimedes and Acorn. So there are finds from IRC. Does anyone else want to have a go?
Yeah. Well, actually, somebody else sent in a find for me to read out. So
that's nice.
Saved me doing lots of hard work. This is from Dave Allen, who talks about how he uses the Dolphin file manager in KDE a lot and is often hitting the F5 key to refresh things when he's downloading to see if files are there. And he says, one day I go to hit F5 and accidentally hit F4, which is when some magic happened. A terminal opened as part of Dolphin along the bottom and it CD'd into the directory I was in. Quite often, I'm in Dolphin doing stuff, and then I open a terminal to go to the same place to do more stuff. So this little revelation is going to save me muchos time. Also, as you CD around in the terminal, Dolphin changes location and vice versa. You probably knew this already, but I found it so useful that I had to mail it to you guys. Give it a go if you've not seen it before. That's you know really that, Graham?
Cool. I did know it, but I've never really used it. But, thank you. Yeah.
This is something I really missed because they took it out of Nautilus, didn't they? As part of the GNOME 3 Simplify Everything drive.
Oh, right. Really? Oh, that's
It wasn't opening, because in Dolphin it opens as part of a pane in the file manager, doesn't it?
And you can do it in Qt as well, the text editor, which is useful.
Yeah, I do it used to do it in Qt quite a bit. But yeah, it just opened a new terminal window in the right directory, which is really handy if you're... Because one time I always find... Well, most useful is when I'm in removable media, because then you're sort of in quite a long convoluted directory.
Yeah, good point.
Especially if you've got a few bits plugged in and they're all mounted by UUID and you don't know.
And different distributions use different schemes for mounting them on the file system, which makes it difficult to predict where they are. Yeah.
And actually, I've been using LXQT the last week or so, and their browser, I think it's PC Manifest, still has the ability to do this. And I've been using it and I've been like, yes, I can actually do it.
Cool. Yeah, I use Yakwake on KDE, which it's bound to F12. So I get to a terminal so quickly that's why I've never really bothered with anything else.
Because it's easier to press F5 than F4.
Yep, so that's my find. Thanks, Dave.
So it's not really your find at all. I've got one that isn't really one, which is why I spent it's not, you know, Pocket. It's a proprietary app, but it's also a plugin for Firefox, and you know, it allows you to save things that you haven't got time to read to an account. So you find an interesting article on Firefox, and if you've got Pocket installed, you just click on it. Basically, creates a virtual bookmark, and then if you've got the app installed on your Android phone or your tablet, then it'll automatically sync that whole document to your phone, so you can read it offline if you have it set to that. It's been around for years. What I've discovered is that it's got a really good text to speech feature. Which I think is genuinely useful. I'm gonna play something now. You can listen to the quality of it.
Machine learning, the high interest credit card of technical debt. Abstract. Machine learning offers a fantastically powerful.
You guys might not be able to hear it so clearly because I got it close to the mic. But that it is dangerous. It's a really good speech synthesizer that allows you to change the speed of playback. Machine learning offers a fantastic. So you can quickly scan through articles if you're listening in the car. Machine learning offers a fantastic. Or if you're doing something else, and it's a really good feature.
It'd be interesting how her voice handles quite technical things, like if she's talking about, I don't know, system D or something.
Yeah, but it's genuinely listenable too, and pretty good if you're doing something else and you haven't got any audio podcasts to listen to, and you want an article or two read out while you're doing something else.
I found Pocket really useful on my tablet, which doesn't have 3G data or mobile data. So I could just sync a load of stuff when I was on Wi-Fi and then read it on the train or wherever.
Yeah, it's a great service actually. It's brilliant for that. There's always stuff in there for when I don't have any data.
My favourite thing about that find was the way that Mike and I both leaned forward
towards our computers to listen to you more closely in Wiltshire, even though the sound's coming through our headphones.
Could you hear it? Could you hear it? Don't know where the mic is.
Yeah.
Only if I lean forward.
You can probably choose a male voice, but it's good. It's perfectly legible.
That leaning forward is almost as big a technical fail as when one of our colleagues from the distant past had a spider on her monitor and tried to use print screen to take a picture of it.
I've spent this weekend trading cryptocurrencies.
As you do.
So I guess what I've learned or found is I've never understood how the stock market actually works. This whole thing of, you know, when you say, oh, I'll sell my shares, who buys them? Why do they buy them instantly? And when you say, oh, buy shares, who's selling them? How does this madness all work? And I learned this through the magic of Bitcoin, because there you can actually see how the exchanges, you can probably do this if you have a suitable account on a finance stock exchange thing, but I never have. And so when you log on to exchange, you see a graph with two lines coming together. One is the buy orders and the other is the sell orders. And the point where these two lines meet are the current trades, basically. So everyone who has Bitcoins is looking to sell them at some point, says, I shall sell two Bitcoins when they reach $250 a Bitcoin or whatever. And all these get amalgamated into this one big line. And the exchange's job is to link people up where the buy orders and sell orders intersect. And it's this changing point that decides the price of, in this case, Bitcoin, but could also be any other currency.
Is there an exchange that's able to visualize all this?
There's several, and the markets.blockchain.info just sort of amalgamates it from a few exchanges, I think. But you can also register an account with a cryptocurrency exchange. I'm on CEX.io, and they visualize it. And you can actually see it change as you put in orders as well, which is quite cool. It's like, I am affecting the market.
Gordon Gecko.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Wolf of Wall Street?
No, but it is on Netflix, so I might.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
So as yet, I have not made any money. But expect me to have retired by the time we do the next podcast.
There's a really good tutorial, and they're all good tutorials, of course, but Andrew Conway in issue 13 has written a tutorial on share prices and grabbing share prices and volume info from the internet. And he's going to build that on that to interpret the data so that you can theoretically do some speculation. Anything, Andrew?
I've got a find, yeah. So this is via the BBC, and it's a story that we'll find the link and put it in the notes somewhere. But there's a story about prisoners in San Quentin Prison in California. Rather than, you know, turf them out when they've served their sentences and just let them, you know, commit a crime and come back into jail, they're taking a novel approach of teaching people digital skills. These digital skills are always described very, very vaguely, of course. Writing web languages that power the internet, that sort of gibberish. But the watching this video, one thing that is obvious is that they're using Ubuntu. So it's never mentioned that it's Linux. The specifics of what language they're using isn't mentioned. There's some very pretty text highlighting, but you can see the Ubuntu dock on the left hand side, and this training is being provided pro bono by a San Francisco company to, you know, get, you know, loads of really awesome publicity for them, which is worth a treat, because normally this course costs $17,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which prison did you say?
San Quentin.
I wonder if that's the one where Hans Reiser is.
It's the one from the Johnny Cash song.
It's the one from the Johnny Cash song, yes. And it's the one that Louis Theroux visited in one of his excellent documentaries, which I think are also on Netflix.
They are, yes.
So yeah, so the hope is that people will learn how to do Python or whatever it is and come out and be able to work for one of the many startups that are in California. But it sounds pretty funky from a technical point of view. They're not allowed any internet access. So they've had to, the trading providers had to package up a lot of the internet and store it locally on these machines or on these, you know, thin clients or whatever sort of network is actually allowed within the prison. Again, very little detail because it's the BBC talking about technology. But it's nice that Ubuntu is used and Linux is used just as the background. It's become not the story now. It's just taken for granted as part of the furniture.
Yeah.
Which is a massive win. And that's my find.
Fabulous.
Which brings us on to Voice of the Neurons, or also known as what is it called? Vocalize your neurons.
Speak your brains.
It actually brings us up neatly onto our halfway reminder. Still to come, there's Speak Your Brains and Voice of the Masses. And perhaps there might be one more thing. We'll have to wait and see.
Yes, the section formerly known as Speak Your Brains, which has gone through extensive rebranding, Vocalize Your Neurons.
Mike's our marketing expert.
It's unbelievable. $10 billion.
Pink ponies.
Naturally.
It's so nice to hear it in the flesh.
I could charge for that.
Could we put it on a mug? Put the waveform on a mug.
We did that. They had the Mike Saunders dartboard back in the day.
Yeah.
Why? What did I say that required me having my face on a dartboard?
I don't know. I didn't agree with it.
Well.
No, sorry about that.
Thanks for defending me, Graham, back then, even though it didn't work.
There was nothing I could do against the might of Nick and Paul. Cry under my desk.
Maybe some people still have the dartboards on their walls. If you do, listeners, drop me a line. Anyway, Ricardo emailed me with a neuron in digitized form. He says, I haven't listened to the latest podcast yet, so forgive me if I'm being redundant, but every time I read or hear about a new so-called catastrophic security flaw that proves Linux is an insecure piece of software, I usually think this is bad, followed by, well, this is not entirely bad. Think of it this way. If people from InfoSec are studying and hacking Linux, this is good because it shows there are serious and professional concerns for our beloved platform. If these exploits are being discovered and fixed, our OS becomes more secure each and every day. That is, yeah, I think fair enough. That is an argument that often comes up. You know, no operating system is free of bugs. No serious size operating system, anyway. and yeah, so yeah, things are going to be discovered. But even when pretty major flaws are found, like in the last year with like Heartbleed and Bash bug and stuff in. Free and open source software and Linux, I still feel more comfortable with it just knowing that these things can be found. How much is lurking away inside the Windows and OS X kernels and libraries and stuff? I mean, yeah, even if this year has three giant vulnerabilities, I'm still more comfortable with open source.
But it's, to me, it's a bit more than just they're getting fixed. And actually, it's a much saner packaging system, I think, on Linux than it is on other OSs, the way that it brings everything together. You got your one updater tool that just grabs the latest version of whatever you need. There's not arbitrary dates made up for when they'll fix bugs. Oh, we'll do it on Tuesday because no one hacks anything until Tuesdays. You know, and all this sort of thing. As long as you just keep to your regular update schedule, you're usually okay, and you've got the options. You can chase the latest versions and constantly do it, or you know, keep to a more stable version, and fixes are backported and everything's sorted.
Yeah, I think like the Debian model, okay, people say Debian's outdated and stuff, but having a distribution that year in, year out will work, and we'll get updates that will not change any functionality, but just keep plugging security holes. I think that's just fantastic. Anyway, thanks, Ricardo. If anybody else wants their neurons vocalized, then email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
Mike, you've written an operating system, haven't you?
Oh, I just, yeah, in a fit of coding frenzy.
So in the last year or so, how many network exploits have been found in your operating system?
Well, I don't know. I suspect that, you know, the black hat market, there might be loads of 0 days out there being sold and passed around. Nobody's contacted me about them yet. But yeah, we'll just have to see. Wait, I'm sure that when I port systemd to macOS, that will make everything better.
What does run as PID 1 on macOS?
Well, given that we don't really have the concept of processes, I guess everything is PID 1.
The kernel. So much like systemd then.
Burn.
Right, that brings us neatly onto Voice of the Masses, in which we asked, what's the best way to fund free software? Now, this comes off the back of Elementary OS, which is another Debian-based, Ubuntu-based operating system in a market that's not short of Debian-based operating systems. But they've always had a downloads page which has asked for some sort of contribution. The default amount has always been $0, which you can then increase up to whatever amount you want. And now the default has changed to $10. Not such a big deal, you would think. You know, clearly they need funding for their project, and you know, freedom isn't free and all that. But this came with a note saying that we want users to understand that they're pretty much cheating the system when they choose not to pay for software. That has since changed now. I think they've taken it down or made the wording slightly less inflammatory. Mm. But it led to our asking the question. Does it help users to realise that FOSS requires funding, or will it just turn people away? If you think it's a terrible idea, how would you go about raising money if you were an Elementary OS dev? Let us know your thoughts in the comments and we'll read out the best. Yeah. Before we
get... Yes, I believe they've changed the wording now, but they haven't sort of really backed off or apologised as far as I'm aware. And looking at some of the comments on like Reddit and stuff, a lot of Elementary fans were really, really angry about this. They're like, look, for starters, you build on Ubuntu and Debian yourselves. Are you donating lots of money back to them? And yeah, nobody's cheating. If you make free and open source software, most people are going to want it for free.
If it's free, really, yeah. Free is the word. So, Mark Johnson, here's a chap who knows what he's talking about. While I don't disagree with Elementary's assertion that it makes sense to discourage the idea that all software, FOSS or otherwise, should be free of cost, to say that people who don't pay are cheating the system seems odd. How much do they pay upstream developers for the software they're distributing? Yes. I've got a little list here of, not a Peter Lilly-style list, a list of sensible comments. Nanu says, if their business model, this is Elementary OS, if their business model to earn money on an Ubuntu rewrap with a dash of eye candy is to shame folk into donating, they may as well cease now and devote their efforts to something more rewarding, like Bitcoin mining. And to be frank, points us in the direction of Amanda Palmer and her excellent TED talk called The Art of Asking. It's not asking at all, it's how you ask. Making people feel that they gate crashed a nightclub and didn't pay at the entrance seems wrong. You know, it is possible to ask and ask in the right way. Stephen Wheeler brings in Red Hat, where the operating system and the source code is freely distributable, freely available. But Red Hat obviously makes a lot of money through selling services. which is, you know, something that Elementary could have a look at. Anybody in the studio?
I think yeah. Firstly, there are several problems. Their wording was terrible, awful. Also, Elementary's had some. They've kind of flirted with the idea of proprietary development in the past. I think it's difficult. There isn't a solution. It reminds me of ADA, the digital audio workstation software, where Paul Nolan, also the creator behind Jack, you know, prints how much money he's getting each month and how many people have contributed in terms of funds and how much he needs. And he needs something like $45,000 a year for it to be worth his while. And also his wording is also a bit sketchy in the default amounts and how difficult it is to download a binary for OS 10, that is. And I suspect that that comes from him knowing precisely how many places are using ADA on OS 10 and how many downloads he's having to supply and perhaps the extent of support he's having to provide. And these are the things that we don't see from this side of the download site. And it may be the same with Elementary OS. They may have just heard about another 10,000 PCs with Elementary OS installed, and, you know, maybe they're struggling to pay their mortgages or they're struggling to find a reason to carry on. And that's it's like a moment of anger that's led to the words that they use. So I'm sympathetic to that as well. But fundamentally, none of this, I think, is going to work. There needs to be a better solution. I don't know. I mean, Firefox is we're about to be able to make micropayments through Firefox. That kind of idea might work. I'm more for more ideas. You know, you put £10 a month into some account somewhere, and you know, you can click on 50 pence for this project or that project, or maybe it's handled automatically. I don't know. But that's the main problem, I think. It's the same with Ubuntu. I mean, Ubuntu asks you to donate when you download an ISO. But there needs to be a better system in place or some other way of getting money to people, because they do need to be paid. There's nothing wrong with them asking for money. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, or they should come up with a business model, like saying, well, you know, we'll sell support or documentation or something. And then if that doesn't work, have a big rant. But,
yeah,
you know, the free, like Andrew said, there's already a million Ubuntu-based distros out there anyway. Elementary OS is pretty cool, and they're doing some interesting things with the design. But yeah, it's not a market you're going to make lots of money in. So come up with something different. Come up with another way to make money from the software.
I mean, making money from a desktop distro has been tried a lot of times. There's Lindows and...
Zandros.
Yeah.
Turbo Linux.
And to be honest, it does surprise me that they don't fail, but then I don't understand marketing. But I don't think that's going to change. I don't think someone's going to come along with some desktop version of Linux and make it a commercial success. Not without a hardware tie-in, anyway.
No. Yeah.
That's just the market we're in. So I've always been a bit disappointed that there's no sort of umbrella fund that you can donate, say, £10 or £20 a month to or whatever, and they look at what's needed, whether it's GPG development or whatever else. Because if you want to fund the Linux as a desktop system, it's actually really hard. Who gets your money? You know, the packages, the 1,001 projects that make it work.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like when you go into your Humble Bundle and you can donate to the EFF. And the EFF is genuinely a worthy cause. But I would really like to be able to donate to a whole chunk of open source projects as well.
Yeah.
And in things like that. Because
that's a really great idea. You know, what you need is a system where, yeah, you need a foundation, you give them £10 a month, and then maybe you get some options for where you want that split to go. And unless you change it, it goes to those every month. You know, so you choose Mozilla and you choose KDE and you choose...
Well, I'd quite like to be able to donate to, say, core infrastructure or security or desktop usability.
But that foundation, because the difficult part is actually finding a way of giving money to those people. So
exactly
what that actual initiative does is have pathways to the people and ways of giving them money.
Yeah, because I mean, the average desktop user probably doesn't realize the different software involved in making a system work.
Yeah.
I mean,
or you could choose to just give the £10 to the top 10% or the bottom 10% or something like that.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. The Linux Foundation, I feel, should be doing stuff like this as well. But
yeah. How much does their chief executive get paid?
I mean, they do have some budget for this, like the 60K that they gave to GPG. But it's not... it's not someone you'd feel you could donate to, and they would just distribute it amongst free software as needed.
I think, you know, in general, and maybe it's a question we should ask at a future time, the Linux Foundation could do an awful lot more, and I don't think it's particularly motivated to do any more than it's doing. It has a monopoly on a lot of things to do with the Linux brand, and it seems to me to use that monopoly a lot to further its own advantage rather than the advantage of people using Linux and free software.
It's something I've often wondered that we could possibly get into if our 50% profit ever turned out to be more than a little.
Yeah, yeah.
You could sort of chuck in a bit extra more that just went into that pot and we distributed it up.
Or if we ended up creating a system to do this anyway, you know, exactly, for ourselves, yeah, to give the money away, that we may actually just turn that into an open platform. And well, not an open platform, but create a foundation that manages it.
Exactly.
It is a really good point, a good question. I really like the idea, Ben. I really like it a lot.
Yes, I do too, which is why I've been nodding, but I realise that that doesn't translate well into sound. If we can go back to the internet, Kevin O'Brien says, if you have to go to the extent of accusing your users of being rip-off artists, maybe you're doing something wrong. I understand that it takes money, and I donate. A couple of days ago, I donated to OpenBSD to support their OpenSSH work, but right now I feel really good about not being an elementary OS user. The if you accusing your users of being rip-off artists, I get that feeling every time I watch a DVD that I've paid for, when there's you wouldn't steal a car, you wouldn't steal a laptop. No, but those adverts are targeted at entirely the wrong people.
I know.
People you've paid to be in the cinema, and then you get treated to the finger wagging. Oh, you're scum.
It really does make me not want to pay for video content when I see these adverts.
Absolutely.
It's completely wrong. You are not stealing. The intellectual property is a complete misnomer. You do not own the intellectual property. What you own is a temporary monopoly on the distribution of that intellectual creation. And when people try and conflate it with theft, it really frustrates me, because it is not.
And you can't skip the trailers either on lots of DVDs.
Yeah.
What really annoyed me actually a while ago is I played a DVD, and for some reason it had a load of this stuff at the end of it. And it wouldn't let me turn off the DVD player until it finished playing.
You had to sit and learn who the best boy in the key grip at the Gaffer and people were.
Yeah.
It is awful.
No, so it had all the you wouldn't steal a whatever.
Oh.
Just eject the damn disc.
So, again, more rage from Ben. Last time in the recording of this this podcast, when Ben got a bit of rage, his sound cut out. So try and think of birds and cool breeze, Ben. Rakios says, if they're asking for money for their distribution, does this mean they will contribute a percentage of that to all the projects whose software they use to make their distribution? That's a question which is just left there. Dodo Bird. Step one, learn how to program, understand operating systems. Step two, have nifty ideas. Databases are a cash cow. Step three has gone missing. Presumably that's marketing.
it's only there for the first 5 minutes of the morning.
Step four is the three little dots. Step five, sell everything to Red Hat, Facebook or Microsoft with the GPL attached. Step six, profit. Easy. I don't know why we're not all doing that. Connie makes a great point. I might suggest starting a magazine that uses half the profits to fund FOSS projects.
Great checking, idea in principle.
Great idea, yeah. joking aside. thanks, Cuddy. Joking aside, the best way is to provide software and then provide optional value-added, paid-for components, such as a paid-for manual, Inkscape, for instance, paid-for support, which would be applicable to many distros, paid-for hardware, the Mint box would be a good example of that, paid-for service or training, such as in WordPress. Development of FOSS also comes because vendors see a benefit from having a community-assisted software development for their hardware projects. Yeah, who said that earlier about distros? Oh, well done, Mike. Mike wins. Yeah. two more points to come. Burgess Meredith says, Elementary does offer quite a bit more than most Ubuntu respins. It's polished and slick, has its own well-designed desktop environment, runs fast, and you can tell that talented people have put a lot of time and effort into it. A very high-quality distro. Despite this, it just wasn't my cup of tea, and I'm glad I didn't pay to try it. I would, however, recommend it for others to try. As far as the cheaters comment, it sounds to me like someone poorly chose their words in a moment of frustration.
Yeah.
I get it. Anyone wanting a real guilt trip should try downloading and installing eLive without making a donation. Oh, I've not tried that.
Or downloading anything off SourceForge.
Yeah.
And then, yes, the final comment, Gravedigger27 says, he or she has actually made two comments, the first of which we've pretty much covered with the Linux Mint, Zorin. There's so many Ubuntu-based spins, and there's so many projects that have tried to monetize desktop OSs. But he signs off with, as long as Elementary OS continues to post 100% free at the bottom of their homepage and make the comment that Elementary OS is completely free, both in terms of pricing and licensing, it's hard to imagine that people who download the distribution are cheating the system. If I have to pay for it, it's not free. Yeah. While going through this, I had a thought. Maybe the... if you make the first download or the first installation free, and then when it comes to upgrade time, if there's a little box you can click to give them £2, I'm sure loads of people would do that, because if there are so many options out there that the substitute goods are there in abundance. So if Ubuntu costs a tenner, but Debian is free.
Yeah.
Then, the advantage that you get from Ubuntu is probably, at that point, at choosing which to install,
yeah,
the benefit is probably not £10. But if you've installed Ubuntu, or Elementary indeed, and you've had it running for 6 months, and now it's time for an upgrade, then that becomes a faff. That is then a hassle. Do you back everything up, reinstall, transfer all your data over? Or, if you can pay for an upgrade, do it in situ, and it'll take you half an hour, and your data is safe, and that costs £2. I'd probably pick the option that allowed me to save my time and effort.
Yeah, I just had an idea, furthering Ben's idea, that with this monthly thing where you put in £10 into a kitty, you could create an API where, so at that point where you're paying to upgrade, you just say, take this £2 from my next 10-month my next monthly payment. So it's like a system. Yes. It all goes through the central pool, but you're saying, actually, add Elementary OS. I want 20% of my monthly to go to Elementary OS this month, and that could just be one click. So you could see lots of projects doing that. So you don't have to get out your card details or do any of that stuff, which puts a lot of us off.
And if you really wanted to get into it, you could tie it into apt-get or yum or whatever. Yeah, so it actually looked at what you had installed. You could probably make it so it worked at how many times they were running.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you wouldn't need to. If you just wanted to donate in general to free software, you could also do that.
And I think I quite like that idea. It sounds like quite a cool, geeky thing to do.
Yeah. And you can, once you've got the pool that distributes the money, you can do anything with that. You can add it to, I don't know, Humble Bundle type things where you can sell t-shirts and it all goes into the pool.
Yeah.
The bit that we're missing is the pool of money and the way of distributing it out.
I wonder if we could crowdfund it. With all that spare time we've got.
Yeah.
Hmm. We could make Ben senior vice president in charge of investing all the money in Bitcoin. So that's the voice of the masses. Thanks very much, masses. It's being accused by your community of cheating is quite inflammatory, but it's you know, there's been no inflammation. Everybody's just really cool about it and just talking about the issues, you know, in a measured and calm way, which is so rare for the internet. I imagine I've not read the Reddit thread, but I imagine it's just full of anger and horridness.
And remember, if you listen to this podcast without buying the magazine, you're basically cheating the system.
You're stealing. And you're funding terrorism.
You wouldn't download a car.
Yeah. Ben is our marketing expert.
I should point out that you are, in fact, perfectly free to listen to this podcast without downloading the magazine or purchasing it.
That's pretty much the end of it, isn't it? That's the end of this one.
The end.
Yeah,
we'll crawl back to our beds now.
Get some lemsy.
Yeah.
Actually, we should add a bit of marketing at the end. That magazine that we do, Linux Voice, which is available in shops and Barnes & Noble, WH Smith Travel, it's also available for free. Rather, the first three issues are now available in PDF and EPUB as well. Is that right, Mike? Or just PDF?
I think so, or at least for issues 2 and 3, I think, are EPUBs. Who did them, Graham?
Okay, so in fact, yeah, we've had one of our users from the forums has created EPUBs of those early editions, which is really, really good of him. And that's Murika from the Murika. So he's done his own conversion of those early issues. And it won't be too long until Ben's early beta versions of EPUBs will start coming with the Creative Commons versions as well.
Yes, and those can, the EPUBs can be extracted into plain HTML files as well. So we've released the first three issues now as Creative Commons so that people can actually update and modify the content. And it's not just a freebie giveaway. It's we want people to reuse things, update things when tutorials get dated and stuff. So
And create EPUB versions out of
And I haven't abandoned the audio edition stuff. I just have been really short of time. I think we'll carry on with them. We'll see if we can carry on with them with issue 3. I've got all the files together for issue 2, so I'll put them up in the next couple of days anyway and see how we get on. But I haven't totally abandoned it. And there was a post on the Linux Voice forums to ask whether people were interested in it, and there wasn't that much of a response.
No.
So if anybody does actually find them useful, let us know and we'll put some effort into it. I know, and I've had a few emails from people who want to help contribute, so there's still lots of interest in generating them. And that's it.
Yep.
Oh, yes, download the first three issues. If you like it, buy a subscription.
And that's it for episode 3, series 3 of the Linux Voice podcast. Thanks, everyone. Thanks
See
for
See you in 2 weeks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.